Chapter 21. Traces of the Sabbath During the Dark Ages. With the accession of the Roman bishop to supremacy began the Dark Ages, and as he increased in strength, the gloom of darkness settled with increasing intensity upon the world. The highest elevation of the papal power marks the latest point in the Dark Ages before the first gray dawn of twilight. That power was providentially weakened preparatory to the Reformation of the 16th century, when the light of advancing day began to manifestly dissipate the gross darkness which covered the earth. The difficulty of tracing the true people of God through this period is well set forth in the following language of Benedict. Quote, "As scarcely any fragment of their history remains, all we know of them is from accounts of their enemies, which were always uttered in the style of censure and complaint, and without which we should not have known that millions of them ever existed. It was the settled policy of Rome to obliterate every vestige of opposition to her doctrines and decrees. Everything heretical, whether persons or writings by which the faithful would be liable to be contaminated and led astray. In conformity to this, their fixed determination, all books and records of their opposers were hunted up and committed to the flames. Before the art of printing was discovered in the 15th century, all books were made with the pen. The copies, of course, were so few that their concealment was much more difficult than it would be now. And if a few of them escaped the vigilance of the inquisitors, they would soon be worn out and gone. None of them could be admitted and preserved in the public libraries of the Catholics from the ravages of time and of the hands of barbarians with which all parts of Europe were at different periods overwhelmed." Close quote. The first 5 centuries of the Christian era accomplished the suppression of the Sabbath in those churches which were under the special control of the Roman pontiff. Thenceforward, we must look for the observers of the Sabbath outside the communion of the Church of Rome. It was predicted that the Roman power should cast down the truth to the ground. The Scriptures set forth the law of God as His truth. The Dark Ages were the result of this work of the great apostasy. So dense and all-pervading was the darkness that God's pure truth was more or less obscured even with the true people of God in their places of retirement. About the year 600, as we have seen, there was in the city of Rome itself a class of Sabbath-keeping Christians who were very strict in the observance of the fourth commandment. It has been said of them that they joined with this a strict abstinence from labor on Sunday. But Dr. Twiss, a learned first-day writer who has particularly examined the record respecting them, asserts that this Sunday observance pertained to, quote, "other persons different from the former," close quote. These Sabbath keepers were not Romanists, and the Pope denounced them in strong language. The Christians of Great Britain, before the mission of Augustine to that country, A.D. 596, were not in subjection to the Bishop of Rome. They were, in an eminent degree, Bible Christians. They are thus described, quote, "The Scottish Church, when it first meets the eye of civilization, is not Romish, nor even prelatical. When the monk Augustine, with his 40 missionaries in the time of the Saxon Heptarchy, came over to Britain under the auspices of Gregory, the Bishop of Rome, to convert the barbarian Saxons, he found the northern part of the island already well nigh filled with Christians and Christian institutions. These Christians were the Caldees, whose chief seat was the little island of Hy or Iona on the western coast of Scotland. An Irish presbyter, Columba, feeling himself stirred with missionary zeal and doubtless knowing the wretched condition of the savage Scots and Picts, in the year 565, took with him 12 other missionaries and passed over to Scotland. They fixed their settlement on the little island just named, and from that point became the missionaries of all Scotland, and even penetrated into England. The people in the south of England converted by Augustine and his assistants, and those in the north who had been won by Caldee labor, soon met as Christian conquest advanced from both sides, and when they came together, it was soon seen that Roman and Caldee Christianity very decidedly differed in a great many respects. The Caldees, for the most part, had a simple and primitive form of Christianity, while Rome presented a vast accumulation of superstitions and was arrayed in her well-known pomp. The Caldee went to Iona that in quiet, with meditation, study, and prayer, he might fit himself for going out into the world as a missionary. Indeed, Iona was a great mission institute, where preachers were trained who evangelized the rude tribes of Scotland in a very short time. To have done such a work as this in less than half a century implies apostolic activity, purity, and success. After the success of Augustine and his monks in England, the Caldees had shut themselves up within the limits of Scotland and had resisted for centuries all the efforts of Rome to win them over. At last, however, they were overthrown by their own rulers. Close quote. There is strong incidental evidence that Columba, the leading minister of his time among the Caldees, was an observer of the ancient Sabbath of the Bible. On this point, I quote two standard authors of the Roman Catholics. They certainly have no motive to put such words as I here quote fraudulently into the mouth of Columba, for they claim him as a saint, and they are no friends of the Bible Sabbath. Nor can we see how Columba could have used these words with satisfaction, as he evidently did, when dying had he all his life long been a violator of the ancient rest day of the Lord. Here are the words of Dr. Alvin Butler, quote, "Having continued his labors in Scotland 34 years, he clearly and openly foretold his death, and on Saturday the 9th of June said to his disciple Dermot, 'This day is called the Sabbath, that is, the day of rest, and such will it truly be to me, for it will put an end to my labors.'" Close quote. Another distinguished Catholic author gives us his dying words thus, quote, "Today is Saturday, the day which the Holy Scriptures call the Sabbath, or rest, and it will be truly my day of rest, for it shall be the last of my laborious life." Close quote. These words show, 1, that Columba believed that Saturday was the true Bible Sabbath, 2, that he did not believe the Sabbath had been changed to Sunday, 3, that his confession of faith respecting the Bible Sabbath was made with evident satisfaction, though in view of immediate death. Did any first-day man ever recur with pleasure on his deathbed to the fact that Saturday is the Bible Sabbath? But Gilfillan quotes these words of Columba as spoken in behalf of Sunday. In giving a list of eminent men who have asserted the change of the Sabbath, or who have called Sunday the Sabbath, and have taught that it should be observed as a day of sacred rest, he brings in Columba thus, quote, "The testimony of Columba is specially interesting, as it expresses the feelings of the heart at a moment which tests the sincerity of faith and the value of a creed. This day," he said to his servant, "in the sacred volume is called the Sabbath, that is, rest, and will indeed be a Sabbath to me, for it is to me the last day of this toilsome life, the day on which I am to rest," and in parentheses it says sabbatize, "after all my labors and troubles, for on this coming sacred night of the Lord," and in parentheses it says Dominica Nocte, "at the midnight hour I shall, as the Scriptures speak, go the way of my fathers." Close quote. But this day which Columba said will indeed be a Sabbath to me was not Sunday but Saturday. Among the dissenters from the Romish Church in the period of the Dark Ages, the first place, perhaps, is due to the Waldenses, both for their antiquity and the wide extent of their influence and doctrine. Benedict quotes from their enemies respecting the antiquity of their origin. Quote, "We have already observed from Claudius Caecil, the popish archbishop, that one Leo was charged with originating the Waldensian heresy in the valleys, in the days of the Constantine the Great. When those severe measures emanated from the Emperor Honorius against rebaptizers, the Baptist left the seat of opulence and power and sought retreats in the country, and in the valleys of Piedmont, which last place in particular became their retreat from imperial oppression." Close quote. Dean Waddington quotes the following from Rainer Sacco, a popish writer who had the best means of information respecting them. Quote, "There is no sect so dangerous as the Leonists, for three reasons. First, it is the most ancient, some say as old as Sylvester, Pope in Constantine's time, others as the apostles themselves. Secondly, it is very generally disseminated. There is no country where it has not gained some footing. Thirdly, while other sects are profane and blasphemous, this retains the utmost show of piety. They live justly before men and believe nothing respecting God which is not good." Close quote. Mr. Jones gives Sacco's own opinion as follows. Quote, "Their enemies confirm their great antiquity. Ranarius Sacco, an inquisitor and one of their most cruel persecutors, who lived only 80 years after Waldo, A.D. 1160, admits that the Waldenses flourished 500 years before that preacher. Gretzer, the Jesuit, who also wrote against the Waldenses and had examined the subject fully, not only admits their great antiquity, but declares his firm belief that the Toulousians and Albigenses condemned in the years 1177 and 1178 were no other than the Waldenses." Close quote. Jorton dates their withdrawal into the wilderness of the Alps as follows. Quote, "A.D. 601, in the 7th century, Christianity was propagated in China by the Nestorians and the Waldenses, who abhorred the papal usurpations, are supposed to have settled themselves in the valleys of Piedmont. Monkery flourished prodigiously, and the monks and popes were in the firmest union." Close quote. President Edwards says, quote, "Some of the popish writers themselves own that this people never submitted to the Church of Rome. One of the popish writers speaking of the Waldenses says, the heresy of the Waldenses is the oldest heresy in the world. It is supposed that they first betook themselves to this place among the mountains to hide themselves from the severity of the heathen persecutions which existed before Constantine the Great. And thus the woman fled into the wilderness from the face of the serpent," Revelation 12, verses 6 and 14, "and to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent. The people being settled there, their posterity continued there from age to age, and being, as it were, by natural walls, as well as by God's grace, separated from the rest of the world, they never partook of the overflowing corruption." Close quote. Benedict makes other quotations relative to their origin. Quote, "Theodore Belvedere, a popish monk, says that the heresy had always been in the valleys. In the preface to the French Bible, the translators say that they, the Waldenses, have always had the full enjoyment of the heavenly truth contained in the Holy Scriptures ever since they were enriched with the same by the apostles, having in fair manuscripts preserved the entire Bible in their native tongue from generation to generation." Close quote. Of the extent to which they spread in the countries of Europe, Benedict thus speaks, quote, "In the 13th century, from the accounts of Catholic historians, all of whom speak of the Waldenses in terms of complaint and reproach, they had founded individual churches or were spread out in colonies in Italy, Spain, Germany, the Netherlands, Bohemia, Poland, Lithuania, Albania, Lombardy, Milan, Romagna, Vicenza, Florence, Velipontine, Constantinople, Philadelphia, Sclavonia, Bulgaria, Dalmatia, Livonia, Sarmatia, Croatia, Dalmatia, Britain, and Piedmont. Close quote. And Dr. Edgar gives the words of an old historian as follows, quote, "The Waldensians," says Pupliner, "spread not only through France, but also through nearly all the European coasts, and appeared in Gaul, Spain, England, Scotland, Italy, Germany, Bohemia, Saxony, Poland, and Lithuania." Close quote. According to the testimony of their enemies, they were to some extent divided among themselves. Dr. Alex quotes an old Romish writer who says of that portion of them who were called Cathari, quote, "They are also divided amongst themselves, so what some of them say is again denied by others." Close quote. And Crosby makes a similar statement, quote, "There were several sects of Waldenses or Albigenses, like as there are of dissenters in England. Some of these did deny all baptism, others only the baptism of infants." That many of them were of this latter opinion is affirmed in several histories of this people, as well ancient as modern. Close quote. Some of their enemies affirm that they reject the Old Testament, but others with much greater truthfulness bear a very different testimony. Thus a Romish inquisitor, as quoted by Alex, bears testimony concerning those in Bohemia. Quote, "They can say a great part of the Old and New Testaments by heart. They despise the decretals and the sayings and expositions of holy men and only cleave to the text of Scripture. They say that the doctrine of Christ and the apostles is sufficient to salvation, without any church statutes and ordinances, that the traditions of the church are no better than the traditions of the Pharisees, and that greater stress is laid on the observation of human traditions than on the keeping of the law of God. Why do you transgress the law of God by your traditions?" They condemn all approved ecclesiastical customs which they do not read of in the gospel, as the observation of Candlemas, Palm Sunday, the reconciliation of penitence, the adoration of the cross on Good Friday. They despise the feast of Easter and all other festivals of Christ and the saints because of their being multiplied to that vast number, and say that one day is as good as another, and work upon holy days where they can do it without being taken notice of. Close quote. Dr. Alex quotes a Waldensian document of A.D. 1100 entitled the, quote, "Noble Lesson," close quote, and remarks, quote, "The author, upon supposal that the world was drawing to an end, exhorts his brethren to prayer, to watchfulness, to a renouncing of all worldly goods. He sets down all the judgments of God in the Old Testament as the effects of a just and good God, and in particular the Decalogue as a law written by the Lord of the whole world. He repeats the several articles of the law, not forgetting that which respects idols." Close quote. Their religious views are further stated by Alex, quote, "They declare themselves to be the apostles' successors, to have apostolic authority and the keys of binding and loosing. They hold the Church of Rome to be the whore of Babylon, and that all that obey her are damned, especially the clergy that are subject to her since the time of Pope Sylvester. They hold that none of the ordinances of the Church that have been introduced since Christ's ascension ought to be observed, as being of no worth. The feasts, fasts, orders, blessings, offices of the Church, and the like, they utterly reject." Close quote. A considerable part of the people called Waldenses bore the significant designation of Sabbatai, or Sabbatati, or Insabbatati. Mr. Jones alludes to this fact in the following words, quote, "Because they would not observe saints' days, they were falsely supposed to neglect the Sabbath also, and called Insabbatati or Insabbathists." Close quote. Mr. Benedict makes the following statement, quote, "We find that the Waldenses were sometimes called Insabbathos, that is, regardless of Sabbaths. Mr. Milner supposes this name was given to them because they observed not the Romish festivals and rested from their ordinary occupations only on Sundays. A Sabbatarian would suppose that it was because they met for worship on the seventh day and did regard not the first day Sabbath." Close quote. Mr. Robinson gives the statements of three classes of writers respecting the meaning of these names which were borne by the Waldenses, but he rejects them all, alleging that these persons were led to these conclusions by the apparent meaning of the words and not by the facts. Here are his words, quote, "Some of these Christians were called Sabbati, Sabbatati, Insabbatati, and more frequently Insabbatati. Led astray by sound without attending to facts, one says they were so named from the Hebrew word Sabbath, because they kept the Saturday for the Lord's Day. Another says they were so called because they rejected all the festivals or Sabbaths in the Low Latin sense of the word, which the Catholic Church religiously observed. A third says, and many with various alterations and additions have said after him, they were called so from Sabbat or Zabbat, a shoe, because they distinguished themselves from other people by wearing shoes marked on the upper part with some peculiarity. Is it likely that people who could not descend from their mountains with hazarding their lives through the furious zeal of the inquisitors should tempt danger by affixing a visible mark on their shoes? Besides, the shoe of the peasants happens to be famous in this country. It was of a different fashion and was called a barca." Close quote. Mr. Robinson rejects these three statements and then gives his own judgment that they were so called because they lived in the mountains. These four views cover all that has been advanced relative to the meaning of these names. But Robinson's own explanation is purely fanciful and seems to have been adopted by no other writer. He offers, however, conclusive reasons for rejecting the statement that they took their name from their shoes. There remained, therefore, only the first and second of these four statements, which are that they are called by these names because they kept the Saturday for the Lord's Day, and because they did not keep the Sabbaths of the Papists. These two statements do not conflict. In fact, if one of them be true, it almost certainly follows that the other one must be true also. There would be in such facts something worthy to give a distinguishing name to the true people of God, surrounded by the great apostasy, and the natural and obvious interpretation of the names would disclose the most striking characteristic of the people who bore them. Jones and Benedict agree with Robinson in rejecting the idea that the Waldenses received these names from their shoes. Mr. Jones held, on the contrary, that they were given them because they did not keep the Romish festivals. Mr. Benedict favors the view that it was because they kept the seventh day. But let us now see who they are that make these statements respecting the observance of the Sabbath by the Waldenses that Robinson alludes to in this place. He quotes out of Gretzer the words of the historian Goldustus as follows, quote, "Insabbatari they were called, not because they were circumcised, but because they kept the Jewish Sabbath." Close quote. Goldustus was, quote, "a learned historian and jurist born near Biskopzell in Switzerland in 1576, close quote. He died in 1635. He was a Calvinist writer of note. He certainly had no motive to favor the cause of the seventh day. Gretzer objects to his statement on the ground that the Waldenses exterminated every festival. But this was the most natural thing in the world for men who had God's own rest day in their keeping. Gretzer still further objects that the Waldenses denied the whole Old Testament. But this charge is an utter misrepresentation, as we have already shown in the present chapter. Robinson also quotes on this point the testimony of Archbishop Usher. Though that prelate held that the Waldenses derived these names from their shoes, he frankly acknowledges that many understood that they were given to them because they worshipped on the Jewish Sabbath. This testimony is valuable in that it shows that many early writers asserted the observance of, quote, the Saturday for the Lord's Day, close quote, by the people who were called Sabbatari. In consequence of the persecutions which they suffered, and because also of their own missionary zeal, the people called Waldenses were widely scattered over Europe. They bore, however, various names in different ages and in different countries. We have decisive testimony that some of these bodies observe the seventh day. Others observe Sunday. Ennius Silvius says that those in Bohemia hold, quote, that we are to cease from working on no day except the Lord's Day, close quote. This statement, let it be observed, relates only to Bohemia. But it has been asserted that the Waldenses were so distinct from the Church of Rome they could not have received the Sunday Lord's Day from thence, and must therefore have received it from the apostles. But a few words from D'Aubigny will suffice to show that this statement is founded in error. He describes an interview between Ecolampadius and two Waldensian pastors who had been sent by their brethren from the borders of France and Piedmont to open communication with the reformers. It was at Basel in 1530. Many things which they said pleased Ecolampadius, but some things he disapproved. D'Aubigny makes this statement, quote, the Barbs, the Waldensian pastors, were at first a little confused at seeing that the elders had to learn of their juniors. However, they were humble and sincere men, and the Basel doctor, having questioned them on the sacraments, they confessed that through weakness and fear they had their children baptized by Romish priests, and that they even communicated with them and sometimes attended Mass. This unexpected avowal startled the meek Ecolampadius. When the deputation returned word to the Waldenses that the reformers demanded of them, quote, a stricter reform, close quote, D'Aubigny says that it was, quote, supported by some and rejected by others, close quote. He also informs us that the demand that the Waldenses should, quote, separate entirely from Rome caused divisions among them, close quote. This is a very remarkable statement. The light of many of these ancient witnesses was almost ready to go out in darkness when God raised up the reformers. They had suffered that woman Jezebel to teach among them and to seduce the servants of God. They had even come to practice infant baptism, and the priests of Rome administered the rite. In addition to all this, they sometimes joined with them in the service of the Mass. If a portion of the Waldenses in southern Europe at the time of the Reformation had exchanged believers' baptism for the baptism of children by Romish priests, it is not difficult to see how they could also accept the Sunday Lord's Day from the same source in place of the hallowed rest day of the Lord. All had not done this, but some certainly had. D'Aubigny makes a very interesting statement respecting the French Waldenses in the 15th century. His language implies that they had a different Sabbath from the Catholics. He tells us some of the stories which the priests circulated against the Waldenses. These are his words, quote, Picardy in the north and Dauphiny in the south were the two provinces of France best prepared at the opening of the Protestant Reformation to receive the gospel. During the 15th century, many Picardons, as the story ran, went to Vaudery. Seated round the fire during the long nights, simple Catholics used to tell one another how the Waldenses met in horrible assembly in solitary places, where they found tables spread with numerous and dainty viands. These poor Christians loved indeed to meet together from districts often very remote. They went to rendezvous by night and along byroads. The most learned of them used to recite some passages of scriptures, after which they conversed together and prayed. But such humble conventicles were ridiculously travestied. Quoting from these simple Catholics, "Do you know what they do to get there?" said the people, "so that the officers may not stop them? The devil has given them a certain ointment, and when they want to go to Vaudery, they smear a little stick with it. As soon as they get astride it, they are carried up through the air and arrive at their Sabbath without meeting anybody. In the midst of them sits a goat with a monkey's tail. This is Satan, who receives their adoration." Close quote. These stupid stories were not peculiar to the people. They were circulated particularly by the monks. It was thus that the Inquisitor Jean de Broussart spoke in 1460 from a pulpit erected in the great square at Arras. An immense multitude surrounded him. A scaffold was erected in front of the pulpit, and a number of men and women, kneeling and wearing caps with the figure of the devil painted on them, awaited their punishment. Perhaps the faith of these poor people was mingled with error, but be that as it may, they were all burnt alive after the sermon. Close quote. It seems that these Waldenses had a Sabbath peculiar to themselves, and D'Aubigné himself alludes to something peculiar in their faith which he cannot confess as the truth and does not choose to denounce as error. He says, quote, "Perhaps the faith of these poor people was mingled with error." Close quote. To speak of the observance of the seventh day as the Sabbath of the Lord by New Testament Christians subjects a conscientious first-day historian to this very dilemma. We have a further account of the Waldenses in France just before the commencement of the Reformation of the 16th century. Quote, "Louis XII, King of France, being informed by the enemies of the Waldenses inhabiting a part of the province of Provence that several heinous crimes were laid to their account, sent the Master of Requests and a certain doctor of the Sorbonne, who was confessor to His Majesty, to make inquiry into this matter. On their return, they reported that they had visited all the parishes where they dwelt, had inspected their places of worship, but that they had found there no images nor signs of the ornaments belonging to the Mass, nor any of the ceremonies of the Romish Church, much less could they discover any traces of those crimes with which they were charged. On the contrary, they kept the Sabbath day, observed the ordinance of baptism according to the primitive church, instructed their children in the articles of the Christian faith and the commandments of God. The king, having heard the report of his commissioners, said with an oath that they were better men than himself or his people." Close quote. We further read concerning the Vaudois or Waldenses as follows. Quote, "The respectable French historian, De Thou, says that the Vaudois keep the commandments of the Decalogue and allow among them of no wickedness, detesting perjures, imprecations, quarrels, seditions, etc." Close quote. It may be proper to add that in 1686, the Waldenses were all driven out of the valleys of Piedmont, and that those who returned and settled in those valleys 3 years afterward, and from whom the present race of Waldenses is descended, fought their way back, sword in hand, pursuing in all respects a course entirely different from that of the ancient Waldenses. Another class of witnesses to the truth during the Dark Ages, bore the name of Cathari, that is, Puritans. Jones speaks of them as follows, quote, "They were a plain, unassuming, harmless, and industrious race of Christians, patiently bearing the cross after Christ, and in both in their doctrines and manners, condemning the whole system of idolatry and superstition which reigned in the Church of Rome, placing true religion in the faith, hope, and obedience of the gospel, maintaining a supreme regard to the authority of God in His Word, and regulating their sentiments and practices by that divine standard. Even in the 12th century, their numbers abounded in the neighborhood of Cologne, in Flanders, the south of France, Savoy, and Milan. They were increased, says Egbert, to great multitudes throughout all countries." Close quote. That the Cathari did retain and observe the ancient Sabbath is certified by their Romish adversaries. Dr. Alex quotes a Roman Catholic author of the 12th century concerning three sorts of heretics, the Cathari, the Passagi, and the Arnoldisti. Alex says of the Romish writer that, quote, "He lays it down also as one of their opinions that the law of Moses is to be kept according to the letter, and that the keeping of the Sabbath, circumcision, and other legal observances ought to take place. They hold also that Christ, the Son of God, is not equal with the Father, and that the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, these three persons, are not one God and one substance, and as a surplus to these their errors, they judge and condemn all the doctors of the Church, and universally the whole Roman Church. Now since they endeavor to defend this, their error, by testimonies drawn from the New Testament and prophets, I shall, with the assistance of the grace of Christ, stop their mouths, as David did Goliath's, with their own sword." Close quote. Dr. Alex quotes another Romish author to the same effect. Quote, "Alanus attributes to the Cathari almost the very same opinions as those just enumerated in his first book against heretics, which he wrote about the year 1192. Close quote. Mr. Eliot mentions an incident concerning the Cathari which is in harmony with what these historians assert respecting their observance of the seventh day. He says, quote, "In this year, A.D. 1163, certain heretics of the sect of the Cathari, coming from the parts of Flanders to Cologne, took up their abode secretly in a barn near the city. But, as on the Lord's Day, they did not go to church, they were seized by the neighbors and detected. In their being brought before the Catholic Church, when, after long examination respecting their sect, they would be convinced by no evidence, however convincing, but most pertinaciously persisted in their doctrine and resolution, they were cast out from the church and delivered into the hands of the laics. These, leading them without the city, committed them to the flames, being four men and one little girl." Close quote. These statements are made respecting three classes of Christian people who lived during the Dark Ages, the Cathari, or Puritans, the Arnoldisti, and the Passaginians. Their views are presented in the uncandid language of their enemies, but the testimony of ancient Catholic historians is decisive that they were observers of the seventh day. The charge that they observed circumcision also will be noticed presently. Mr. Robinson understands that the Passaginians were that portion of the Waldenses who lived in the passes of the mountains. He says, quote, "It is very credible that the name Passageros or Passagini was given to such of them as lived in or near the passes or passages of the mountains, and who subsisted in part by guiding travelers or traveling themselves for trade." Close quote. Mr. Eliot says of the name Passagini, quote, "The explanation of the term as meaning pilgrims, in both the spiritual and missionary sense of the word, would be but the translation of their recognized Greek appellation, and a title as distinctive as beautiful. Close quote. Mosheim gives the following account of them. Quote, in Lombardy, which was the principal residence of the Italian heretics, there sprung up a singular sect known, for what reason I cannot tell, by the denomination of Pasaginians, and also by that of the circumcised. Like the other sects already mentioned, they had the utmost aversion to the dominion and discipline of the Church of Rome, but they were at the same time distinguished by two religious tenets which are peculiar to themselves. The first was a notion that the observance of the law of Moses, in everything except the offering of sacrifices, was obligatory upon Christians, in consequence of which they circumcised their followers, abstained from those meats the use of which was prohibited under the Mosaic economy, and celebrated the Jewish Sabbath. The second tenet that distinguished this sect was advanced in opposition to the doctrine of three persons in the divine nature. Close quote. Mr. Benedict speaks of them as follows. Quote, the account of their practicing circumcision is undoubtedly a slanderous story forged by their enemies, and probably arose in this way. Because they observed the seventh day, they were called by way of derision Jews, as the Sabbatarians are frequently at this day. And if they were Jews, it followed, of course, that they either did or ought to circumcise their followers. This was probably the reasoning of their enemies, but that they actually practiced the bloody rite is altogether improbable. Close quote. An eminent church historian, Michael Geddes, thus testifies, quote, this act of fixing something that is justly abominable to all mankind upon her adversaries has been the constant practice of the Church of Rome. Close quote. Dr. Alex states the same fact, which needs to be kept in mind whenever we read of the people of God in the records of the Dark Ages. Quote, I must desire the reader to consider that it is no great sin with the Church of Rome to spread lies concerning those that are enemies of that faith. There is nothing more common with the Romish party than to make use of the most horrid calumnies to blacken and expose those who have renounced her communion. Close quote. Of the origin of the Petrobrusians, we have the following account by Mr. Jones. Quote, but the Cathari or Puritans were not the only sect which, during the 12th century, appeared in opposition to the superstition of the Church of Rome. About the year 1110, in the south of France, in the provinces of Languedoc and Provence, appeared Peter de Bruys preaching the gospel of the kingdom of heaven and exerting the most laudable efforts to reform the abuses and remove the superstition which disfigured the beautiful simplicity of the gospel worship. His labors were crowned with abundant success. He converted a great number of disciples to the faith of Christ, and after a most indefatigable ministry of 20 years' continuance, he was burned at St. Giles, a city of Languedoc, in France, A.D. 1130, by an enraged populace instigated by the clergy, who apprehended their traffic to be in danger from this new and intrepid reformer. Close quote. That this body of French Christians, who, in the very midnight of the Dark Ages, witnessed for the truth in opposition to the Romish Church, were observers of the ancient Sabbath, is expressly certified by Dr. Francis White, Lord Bishop of Ely. He was appointed by the King of England to write against the Sabbath in opposition to Brabourne, who had appealed to the King in its behalf. To show that Sabbatic observance is contrary to the doctrine of the Catholic Church, a weighty argument with an Episcopalian, he enumerates various classes of heretics who had been condemned by the Catholic Church for keeping holy the seventh day. Among these heretics he places the Petrobrusians. Quote, in St. Bernard's day, it was condemned in the Petrobrusians. Close quote. We have seen that, according to Catholic writers, the Cathari held to the observance of the seventh day. Dr. Alex confirms the statement of Dr. White that the Petrobrusians observed the ancient Sabbath by stating that the doctrines of these two bodies greatly resembled each other. These are his words, quote, Petrus Cluniacensis has handled five questions against the Petrobrusians, which bear a great resemblance with the belief of the Cathari of Italy, close quote. The Sabbath keepers in the 11th century were of sufficient importance to call down upon themselves the anathema of the Pope. Dr. Halen says that, quote, Gregory of that name the seventh, about A.D. 1074, condemned those who taught that it was not lawful to do work on the day of the Sabbath, close quote. This act of the Pope corroborates the testimonies we have adduced in proof of the existence of Sabbath keepers in the Dark Ages. Gregory the Seventh was one of the greatest men that ever filled the papal chair. Whatever class he anathematized was of some consequence. Gregory wasted nothing on trifles. In the 11th century, there were Sabbath keepers also in Constantinople and its vicinity. The Pope, in A.D. 1054, sent three legates to the Emperor of the East and to the Patriarch of Constantinople for the purpose of reuniting the Greek and the Latin churches. Cardinal Humbert was the head of this legation. The legates, on their arrival, set themselves to the work of refuting those doctrines which distinguished the Church of Constantinople from that of Rome. After they had attended to the questions which separated the two churches, they found it also necessary to discuss the question of the Sabbath. For one of the most learned men of the East had put forth a treatise in which he maintained that ministers should be allowed to marry, that the Sabbath should be kept holy, and that leavened bread should be used in the supper, all of which the Church of Rome held to be deadly heresies. We quote from Mr. Bauer a concise statement of the treatment which this Sabbatarian writer received. Quote, Humbert likewise answered a piece that had been published by a monk of the monastery of Stadium, near Constantinople, named Nicetas, who was deemed one of the most learned men at the time in the East. In that piece, the monk undertook to prove that leavened bread only should be used in the Eucharist, that Sabbath ought to be kept holy, and that priests should be allowed to marry. But the emperor, who wanted by all means to gain the pope, for the reasons mentioned above, was, or rather pretended to be, so fully convinced with the arguments of the legate, confuting those alleged by Nicetas, that he obliged the monk publicly to recant, and anathematize all who held the opinion that he had endeavored to establish with respect to unleavened bread, the Sabbath, and the marriage of priests. At the same time, Nicetas, in compliance with the command of the emperor, anathematized all who should question the primacy of the Roman Church with respect to all other Christian churches, or should presume to censor her ever-Orthodox faith. The monk, having thus retracted all he had written against the Holy See, his book was burnt by the emperor's order, and he absolved by the legates from the censures he had incurred. Close quote. This record shows that, in the dense darkness of the 11th century, quote, one of the most learned men at that time in the East, close quote, wrote a book to prove that, quote, the Sabbath ought to be kept holy, close quote, and in opposition to the papal doctrine of the celibacy of the clergy. It also shows how the Church of Rome casts down the truth of God by means of the sword of emperors and kings. Though Nicetas retracted, under fear of the emperor and the pope, it appears that there were others who held the same opinions, for he was obliged to anathematize all such, and there is no evidence that any of these persons turned from the truth because of the fall of their leader. Indeed, if there had not been a considerable body of these Sabbatarians, the papal legate would never have deemed it worthy of his dignity to write a reply to Nicetas. The Anabaptists are often referred to in the records of the Dark Ages. The term signifies rebaptizers, and was applied to them because they denied the validity of infant baptism. The designation is not accurate, however, because those persons whom they baptized, they considered as never having been baptized before, although they had been sprinkled or even immersed in infancy. This people have been overwhelmed in obloquy in consequence of the fanatical insurrection which broke out in their name in the time of Luther. Of those engaged in this insurrection, Buck says, quote, "The first insurgents groaned under severe oppressions and took up arms in defense of their civil liberties, and of these commotions the Anabaptists seem rather to have availed themselves than to have been the prime movers. That a great part were Anabaptists seems indisputable. At the same time, it appears from history that a great part also were Roman Catholics, and a still greater part of those who had scarcely any religious principles at all." Close quote. This matter is placed in the true light by Stebbing. Quote, "The overthrow of civil society and fatal injuries to religion were threatened by those who called themselves Anabaptists, but large numbers appear to have disputed the validity of infant baptism, who had nothing else in common with them, yet who, for that one circumstance, were overwhelmed with the obloquy and the punishment richly due to a fanaticism equally fraudulent and licentious." Close quote. The ancient Sabbath was retained and observed by a portion of the Anabaptists, or, to use a more proper term, Baptists. Dr. Francis White thus testifies, quote, "They which maintain the Saturday Sabbath to be in force comply with some Anabaptists." Close quote. In harmony with this statement of Dr. White is the testimony of a French writer of the 16th century. He names all the classes of men who have borne the name of Anabaptists. Of one of these classes he writes thus, quote, "Some have endured great torments because they would not keep Sundays and festival days in despite of Antichrist, seeing they were days appointed by Antichrist. They would not hold forth anything which is like unto him. Others observe these days, but it is out of charity." Close quote. Thus it is seen that within the limits of the old Roman Empire, and in the midst of those countries that submitted to the rule of the Pope, God reserved unto himself a people that did not bow the knee to Baal, and among these the Bible Sabbath was observed from age to age. We are now to search for the Sabbath among those who were never subjected to the Roman Pontiff. In Central Africa, from the first part of the Christian era, possibly from the time of the conversion of the Ethiopian officer of great authority, but very certainly as early as AD 330, have existed the churches of Abyssinia and Ethiopia. About the time of the ascension of the Roman bishop to supremacy, they were lost sight of by the nations of Europe. Encompassed on all sides, says Gibbon, by the enemies of their religion, the Ethiopians slept near 1,000 years, forgetful of the world by whom they were forgotten. In the latter part of the 15th century, they were again brought to the knowledge of the world by the discovery of Portuguese navigators. Undoubtedly, they have been greatly affected by the dense darkness of pagan and Mahometan errors with which they are encompassed, and in many respects they have lost the pure and spiritual religion of our divine Redeemer. A modern traveler says of them, quote, "They have diverse errors and many ancient truths." Close quote. Michael Geddes says of them, quote, "The Abyssinians do hold the Scriptures to be the perfect rule of the Christian faith, insomuch that they deny it to be in the power of a general council to oblige people to believe anything as an article of faith without an express warrant from thence." Close quote. They practice circumcision, but for other reasons than that of a religious duty. Geddes further states their views, quote, "Transubstantiation and the adoration of the consecrated bread in the sacrament were what the Abyssinians abhorred. They deny purgatory and know nothing of confirmation and extreme unction. They condemn graven images. They keep both Saturday and Sunday." Close quote. Their views of the Sabbath are stated by the ambassador of the King of Ethiopia at the court of Lisbon in the following words, explaining their abstinence from all labor on that day. Quote, "Because God, after he had finished the creation of the world, rested thereon, which day, as God would have it called, the Holy of Holies, so the not celebrating thereof with great honor and devotion seems to be plainly contrary to God's will and precept, who will suffer heaven and earth to pass away sooner than his word, and that especially since Christ came not to destroy the law, but to fulfill it. It is not therefore in imitation of the Jews, but in obedience to Christ and his holy apostles that we observe that day." Close quote. The ambassador states their reasons for first day observance in these words. Quote, "We do observe the Lord's Day after the manner of all other Christians in memory of Christ's resurrection." Close quote. He had no scripture to offer in support of this festival, and evidently rested its observance upon tradition. This account was given by the ambassador in 1534. In the early part of the next century, the emperor of Abyssinia was induced to submit to the Pope in these words, quote, "I confess that the Pope is the vicar of Christ, the successor of St. Peter, and the sovereign of the world. To him I swear true obedience, and at his feet I offer my person and kingdom." Close quote. No sooner had the Roman bishop thus brought the emperor to submit to him than that potentate was compelled to gratify the popish hatred of the Sabbath by an edict forbidding its further observance. In the words of Geddes, he, quote, "set forth a proclamation prohibiting all his subjects upon severe penalties to observe Saturday any longer." Or as Gibbon expresses it, quote, "the Abyssinians were enjoined to work and to play on the Sabbath." Close quote. But the tyranny of the Romanists, after a terrible struggle, caused their overthrow and banishment, and the restoration of the ancient faith. The churches resounded with a song of triumph, quote, "that the sheep of Ethiopia were now delivered from the hyenas of the West, and the gates of that solitary realm were forever shut against the arts, the science, and the fanaticism of Europe." Close quote. We have proved in a former chapter that the Sabbath was extensively observed as late as the middle of the 5th century in the so-called Catholic Church, especially in that portion most intimately connected with the Abyssinians, and that from various causes, Sunday obtained certain sabbatic honors in consequence of which the 2 days were called sisters. We have also shown in another chapter that the effectual suppression of the Sabbath in Europe is mainly due to papal influence. And so for 1,000 years we have been tracing its history in the records of those men which the Church of Rome has sought to kill. These facts are strikingly corroborated by the case of the Abyssinians. In consequence of their location in the interior of Africa, the Abyssinians ceased to be known to the rest of Christendom about the 5th century. At this point, the Sabbath and the Sunday in the Catholic Church were counted sisters. 1,000 years later, these African churches are visited, and though surrounded by the thick darkness of pagan and Mohammedan superstition, and somewhat affected thereby, they are found at the end of this period holding the Sabbath and first day substantially as held by the Catholic Church when they were lost sight of by it. The Catholics of Europe, on the contrary, had in the meantime trampled the ancient Sabbath in the dust. Why was this great contrast? Simply because the Pope ruled in Europe, while Central Africa, whatever else it may have suffered, was not cursed with his presence nor with his influence. But so soon as the Pope learned of the existence of the Abyssinian churches, he sought to gain control of them, and when he had gained it, one of his first acts was to suppress the Sabbath. In the end, the Abyssinians regained their independence, and thenceforward till the present time have held fast the Sabbath of the Lord. The Arminians of the East Indies are peculiarly worthy of our attention. J.W. Massey, M.R.I.A., says of the East Indian Christians, quote, "Remote from the busy haunts of commerce or the populous seats of manufacturing industry, they may be regarded as the Eastern Piedmontese, the Valois of Hindustan, the witnesses prophesying in sackcloth through revolving centuries, though indeed their bodies lay as dead in the streets of the city which they had once peopled." Close quote. Geddes says of those in Malabar, quote, "The three great doctrines of popery, the Pope's supremacy, transubstantiation, the adoration of images, were never believed nor practiced at any time in this ancient apostolic church. I think one may venture to say that before the time of the late Reformation, there was no church that we know of, no, not that of the Vaudois, that had so few errors in doctrine as the Church of Malabar." Close quote. He adds concerning those churches, quote, "Where never within the bounds of the Roman Empire, it is in those churches that we are to meet with the least of the leaven of popery." Close quote. Mr. Massey further describes these Christians, quote, "The creed with which these representatives of an ancient line of Christians cherished was not in conformity with papal decrees, and has with difficulty been squared with the 39 articles of the Anglican Episcopacy. Separated from the Western world for 1,000 years, they were naturally ignorant of many novelties introduced by the councils and decrees of the Lateran, and their conformity with the faith and practice of the first ages laid them open to the unpardonable guilt of heresy and schism as estimated by the Church of Rome. We are Christians and not idolaters," was their expressive reply when required to do homage to the image of the Virgin Mary. La Croze states them at 1,500 churches and as many towns and villages. They refused to recognize the Pope and declared they have never heard of him. They asserted the purity and primitive truth of their faith since they came, and their bishops had for 1,300 years been sent from the place where the followers of Jesus were first called Christians. Close quote. The Sabbatarian character of these Christians is hinted by Mr. Yeats. He says that Saturday, quote, "amongst them is a festival day, agreeable to the ancient practice of the church." Close quote. The ancient practice of the church, as we have seen, was to hallow the seventh day in memory of the Creator's rest. This practice has been suppressed wherever the great apostasy has had power to do it. But the Christians of the East Indies, like those of Abyssinia, have lived sufficiently remote from Rome to be preserved in some degree from its blasting influence. The same fact is further hinted by the same writer in the following language. Quote, "The Inquisition was set up at Goa in the Indies at the instance of Francis Xaverius, a famous Romish saint, who signified by letters to Pope John III, November 10, 1545, that the Jewish wickedness spread every day more and more in the parts of the East Indies subject to the kingdom of Portugal, and therefore he earnestly besought the said king that to cure so great an evil he would take care to send the office of the Inquisition into those countries." Close quote. The Jewish wickedness was doubtless the observance of Saturday as, quote, "a festival day agreeable to the ancient practice of the church," close quote, of which this author has just spoken. The history of the past, as we have seen, shows the hatred of the papal church toward the Sabbath. And the struggle of that church to suppress the Sabbath in Abyssinia and to subject that people to the Pope, which at this very point of time was just commencing, shows that the Jesuits would not willingly tolerate Sabbatic observance in the East Indies, even though united with the observance of Sunday also. It appears, therefore, that this Jesuit missionary desired the Pope and the King of Portugal to establish the Inquisition in that part of the Indies, subject to Portugal, in order to root out the Sabbath from those ancient churches. The Inquisition was established in answer to this prayer, and Xavier was subsequently canonized as a saint. Nothing can more clearly show the malignity of the Roman pontiff toward the Sabbath of the Lord, and nothing more clearly illustrates the kind of men that he canonizes as saints. Since the time of Xavier, the East Indies have fallen under British rule. A distinguished clergyman of the Church of England some years since visited the British Empire in India for the purpose of acquainting himself with these churches. He gave the following deeply interesting sketch of these ancient Christians, and in it particularly marks their Sabbatarian character. Quote, "The history of the Armenian Church is very interesting. Of all the Christians in Central Asia, they have preserved themselves most free from Mahometan and papal corruptions. The Pope assailed them for a time with great violence, but with little effect. The churches in Lesser Armenia indeed consented to an union, which did not long continue, but those in Persian Armenia maintained their independence, and they retain their ancient scriptures, doctrines, and worship to this day. It is marvelous," says an intelligent traveler who was much among them, "how the Armenian Christians have preserved their faith equally against the vexatious oppression of the Mahometans, their sovereigns, and against the persuasions of the Romish Church, which for more than two centuries has endeavored by missionaries, priests, and monks to attach them to her communion. It is impossible to describe the artifices and expenses of the court of Rome to effect this object, but all in vain. The Bible was translated into the Armenian language in the 5th century under very auspicious circumstances, the history of which has come down to us. It has been allowed by competent judges of the language to be a most faithful translation. La Cruz calls it the, quote, Queen of Versions, close quote. This Bible has ever remained in the possession of the Armenian people, and many illustrious instances of genuine and enlightened piety occur in their history. The Armenians in Hindustan are our own subjects. They acknowledge our government in India as they do that of the Sophi in Persia, and they are entitled to our regard. They have preserved the Bible in its purity, and their doctrines are, as far as the author knows, the doctrines of the Bible. Besides, they maintain the solemn observance of Christian worship throughout our empire on the seventh day, and they have as many spires pointing to heaven among the Hindus as we ourselves. Are such a people then entitled to an acknowledgment on our part as fellow Christians? Are they forever to be ranked by us with Jews, Mahometans, and Hindus?" Close quote. It has been said, however, that Buchanan might have intended Sunday by the term seventh day. This is a very unreasonable interpretation of his words. Episcopalian clergymen are not accustomed to call Sunday the seventh day. We have, however, testimony which cannot with candor be explained away. It is that of Purchas, written in the 17th century. The author speaks of several sects of the Eastern Christian continuing from ancient times, as Syrians, Jacobites, Nestorians, Maronites, and Arminians. Of the Syrians, or Syrians, as he variously spells the name, who from his relation appear to be identical with the Arminians, he says, quote, "They keep Saturday holy, nor esteem Saturday fast lawful, but on Easter even. They have solemn service on Saturdays, eat flesh, and feast it bravely like the Jews," close quote. This author speaks of these Christians disrespectfully, but he uses the uncandid statements of their adversaries, which indeed are no worse than those often made in these days concerning those who hallow the Bible Sabbath. These facts clearly attest the continued observance of the Sabbath during the whole period of the Dark Ages. The Church of Rome was indeed able to exterminate the Sabbath from its own communion, but it was retained by the true people of God, who were measurably hidden from the papacy in the wilds of Central Europe, while those African and East Indian churches that were never within the limits of the Pope's dominion have steadfastly retained the Sabbath to the present day.